This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Welcome to episode number 250 of FilmWax Radio. I guess that's kind of a big deal. You know, my next episode coming up, number 251, is with Dick Cavett. Maybe I should have made that the 250 and like kind of used the opportunities for the bigger numbers for, I guess, better known people. But I don't care about any of that. Everybody that comes on the show is of equal importance to me. And that's really actually quite true. I mean, yes, am I excited to talk to someone like Barbara Kopple or Ken Burns or, I don't know, Dick Cavett or Bernardo Bertolucci? Of course. But I'm also just as excited to get into a great conversation with the first-time filmmaker, you know, or somebody who's emerging in some fashion or other. And this gives me an opportunity to make a statement since we are at this kind of milestone episode, number 250. You know, I'm about one-fourth of the way to my 1,000th episode, God willing, you know. Maybe my son will be doing the show by then, or someone very lucky out there listening will inherit the show, because there's so few podcasts, as you know. But I was thinking about it lately, and I've started to take on, you know, I interview obviously many documentary filmmakers, and one thing I'm trying to do now is also try to interview the subjects of the documentaries. And so that's actually going to happen on this episode and some of the future episodes coming up. And also taking occasional steps away from purely just film people. So, and what I'm doing is expanding myself and my experiences by doing that. And I've been doing a few of these and I love it. So I have, of course, 99% of the content I'm going to talk about on the show is film, about film. But I'm also going to occasionally dabble outside of just the typical film conversation. So just coming up on this show, for instance, I speak with Jean-Yves Olivier, who is in this documentary called Plot for Peace. I think he sort of generated the whole sort of, you know, the making of it, even though he didn't direct the film. But I have Jean-Yves on here, and he's played a very important role in negotiating the end of apartheid, the freeing of Nelson Mandela, and diplomatically, very, very carefully, making sure that, of course, South Africa didn't just go into some scenario where there would just be massive slaughter, or even some sort of weird situation where white South Africans would emigrate somehow from South Africa, but to where? They didn't have a passport for any other place. So there really was no other solution. So Jean-Yves, who you'll be hearing from in a little bit, well, he helped keep the peace and to bring leaders together to see that there was no other solution without the country falling apart. And he's a very interesting person with a very, very interesting and somewhat complex background, as you'll note. Anyway, he was a really fascinating individual, and I had a pleasure talking to him. Even though, you know, whenever I'm not talking about film, I guess I'm sort of out of my normal terrain, so forgive me for that, but this is the one of several interviews coming up in the coming weeks where we'll be talking about subjects other than film. And I hope you will humor me in that way. Okay, so this is episode number 250, and I already informed you about one of my guests. Another one is I ran into a filmmaker named Jeremy Workman a couple of months ago, if that long. And it turns out he is a documentary filmmaker, a very talented documentary filmmaker, and that he is actually the son of another very talented documentary filmmaker named Chuck Workman, who you may be familiar with if you're big into documentaries. Chuck Workman made the film Superstar about Andy Warhol. He made a documentary called The Source, I think it was, about the Beats. and many others. And he also worked on the Academy Award montages, I believe, and things of that nature. Well, both Jeremy and Chuck have new documentaries coming out in the next weeks. Jeremy's actually comes out this Friday, and it's called Magical Universe. We're going to be talking to Jeremy, but the thing is this: I got them both together, and I sat Jeremy and Chuck in the same room, and I talked to the both of them. And what I'm doing now is, do you remember reading about the life? What is it called? Eleanor Rigby? Was it the ballad of something like that, right? And there was like a him version and a her version and a them version. Well, this is sort of like that, except that, I'm going to be playing Jeremy's, I kind of approached it methodically and strategically. So we spent the first half of the conversation talking about Chuck's film, which is a documentary about Orson Welles called Magician, which I just saw played up at Woodstock. When I was up there, and then we spent the second half of the this conversation focused primarily on Jeremy's film again, Magical Universe. But all throughout, they both kind of pop into. I mean, they're both there, so And in the middle, I sort of engage them both. So the way it works is I'm editing them in such a way where we can play three versions of it. So I'm always trying to find interesting ways of doing my show. So there will be three versions out there in the coming weeks. First, today in this episode, you'll hear the Jeremy Workman segment. Okay. And then last, which is actually going to be the first segment you're going to hear, is filmmaker Margaret Brown, who is a documentary filmmaker. So I guess this is another docutastic episode, since all three guests are talking about documentaries. And Margaret Brown has made a number of feature documentaries, including The Order of the Myths, which was about the Mardi Gras in Mobile, Alabama, where she's from. And then she made a documentary about Townes Van Sant, the country singer-songwriter who wrote like Poncho and Lefty. And then she now has a new documentary called The Great Invisible about the BP oil spill, the enormous environmental disaster that also affected the Gulf Coast of Alabama. So she is quite a person. Well, I mean, all my guests are on this episode, but I have to say that Margaret Brown, lovely meeting her, by the way, Anyway, I'm delighted to talk to her first up. And then we're going to pop in lastly with a friend of mine named Jacqueline Grimina, who did this very, very startling thing. When I talked to her just a few days ago on Skype, she was about to launch a Seed and Spark campaign and a relationship, because I think they not only offer crowdsourced fundraising, but they also actually create all sorts of synergy between their organization through the lifeline of your film. And so she went up there and started her campaign just yesterday, and somebody popped in and gave her all the money. I've never heard of anything like that before. So congratulations to Jacqueline Grimina. So I'm going to put that at the end of the show, but I want you to stick through the entire episode as I talk to Margaret Brown, Jeremy Workman and Chuck Workman, and Jean-Yves Olivier and Jacqueline Grimina. Right now, my conversation with the great invisible documentary feature filmmaker, Ms. Margaret Brown.
The lights went out. Then the first explosion hit us. It flipped me through the air like a rag doll.
I honestly thought that I was going to die in there.
Already I've issued a 6-month moratorium on deep water drilling. We need to know the facts before we continue.
It was a very prestigious job to work on the Deepwater Horizon.
How's my room? 338.
It was an outstanding rig because of the crew that was on it.
We were all up on the front here when everything happened.
Every one of the rig's defenses failed.
there were things that were done to save time and save money.
Transocean started eliminating positions.
When the decision was made to cut corners, it's putting them at increased risk.
We were behind schedule, so it's starting to cost them a lot of money.
They knew the hydraulics weren't working. They knew that there was rubber in the mud that was coming back up. That tells you something.
People are aware that things weren't going properly.
These are things that everybody knows are wrong, and they're still told to keep going.
I like these red microphones.
Yeah, I know. It's like clown noses. No, right, exactly. They're a little dash of color. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
It's like, nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you in person.
Mm-hmm. So what do you want to talk about? We could talk about your movie.
Yeah, we could talk about the movie. We could talk about all the posters in here.
All right. We're in the offices of Cinetic, and I guess they're upstairs. I don't know. Yeah. They're using John Sloss's conference room.
Yeah.
And all the movies that he's worked on, attorneyed or whatever he does.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is attorneyed a word?
No,
I like it though.
I made it up, but it's now going to be on Twitter. That's funny. I don't know that we met before.
I think we just met through email.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just so you're a nomad.
I am kind of a nomad. I lived in New York for a while, mm-hmm. in Austin for a while. Mm-hmm. Now I'm living in L.A. for a while, just sublet to sublet, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that an intentional thing until you feel like?
No, it's more just that I was making a movie that was all over the Gulf Coast, and then we started editing it in Los Angeles.
Right.
So that's kind of the intention, was just to like make the film in what was thought to be the best possible way, which was sort of made it necessary to kind of be a nomad, I guess.
But you are, as you already referenced, a native of Bayou Country. You're from Alabama, but from the pretty close to the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
I
can't be too far.
I'm from Mobile, and that's about. There's a scene at the very beginning of the movie that when the oil hits the beach in the Gulf, and that's about an hour and 15 minutes from the house where I grew up.
Right. So these, so that's two for two. Unless maybe you made films in between that I'm forgetting, but you ordered The Myths, which is about the lesser-known cousin Mardi Gras. It's the yet another
first Mardi Gras,
but it goes back longer.
Yes,
but it's lesser.
It's not as famous as New Orleans, but it's older than.
But it's older. So there's another Mardi Gras for you that don't know this. And
if
you want to get a great portrait of this, watch Order of the Myths, because it's a very really great documentary. So that was in your backyard, and now you're kind of back there with this story. Unfortunately, there seem to be plenty of stories down there in the last bunch of years.
Unfortunately for me, unfortunately for everybody else. But I definitely like to tell films that are Southern stories. I mean, so far, that's sort of all that I've done.
Well, there's a specific, though, culture to, especially, though, to that part of the country, even the South, that's kind of unto itself, you know?
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
And it probably doesn't share with the Texas or with the, you know, I don't know, maybe parts, maybe the
East Texas.
Gulf Coast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I consider Texas the South. I don't know if Texas would consider itself the South.
It's so big, though, that it's partly West, partly South.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, partly its own country.
You can do both.
If you're living parts of it, you probably want to declare yourself your own country.
Yeah,
contextually. Sure. Yeah. But you felt a personal stake, I suppose, when... let me change that into a question. When this oil spill, the worst oil spill ever in this, at least in our borders, occurred, the BP spill.
Mm-hmm. This was... Macondo Well.
Well.
Deepwater Horizon was the name of the rig.
The rig that fell. And when that happened, what was your response to that?
When it first happened, I didn't know that it was going to be such a big deal or it was going to have such a huge effect, maybe naively. But, you know, when it was first reported, BP said that it wasn't leaking when they had, they had ROVs in the ground that showed that it was. And then it was only, 1,000 barrels a day, and it kind of just kept creeping or upward. But, I mean, I think, it became... I don't know. At a certain point, my dad started sending me photos of the house, their house, which was on the water on Mobile Bay. And it was, surrounded by those orange booms that the volunteer fire department, those booms are like these like kind of floating tubes that are supposed to prevent mm-hmm. the oil from reaching the shoreline, mm-hmm. and they would put it in the water. Which, I mean, it's funny they would do that. Again, it was just a cosmetic thing because, you know, there was dispersant used to sink the oil. So if they're using that, this is just to, like, prevent it from... Again, many things in the spill were to look good and not actually... They didn't actually do anything.
It was like a PR job.
Yeah, right. Although in this case, it was the volunteer fire department just trying to do anything to prevent the oil from getting up into the marsh. So that wasn't actually a BP initiative. But yeah, my dad was sending me these pictures of these orange booms and these crews that were like coming. And it's like this foreign, all these like people foreign to that place were just sort of running around. And mm-hmm. there were these booms and these pictures just, I couldn't believe it. It was like this landscape that's usually so beautiful and pristine. And all of a sudden, it was like an army had come in or something. And then seeing these pictures, they really struck me, like and then talking to my dad and other people in my family and just reading, you know, in the news and seeing what people, I have a lot of people from the South who are on my Facebook page and people were posting about it, and I just was like, whoa. And it felt really hopeless, like people were, you know, when a hurricane happens in Alabama, everyone kind of knows what to do, it's like a routine at this point, but with this,
it's also
like,
a natural.
Yeah, exactly. It
feels
natural.
A little less personal.
Yeah, and with this, there was no like blueprint of how to act or what to do, and so there was so much uncertainty. And I just thought, like, well, maybe I can make a movie, mm-hmm. and maybe that's something I can do because, you know, I didn't know what to do. I just felt like it was so weird.
Well, and you had the added advantage of you're a hometown girl in a sense, right? So you make it less. I don't know. It seems that people are very grateful, though, when you're telling a sort of an underdog story, you know, which isn't told, you know, mm-hmm. that often or often enough. Mm-hmm. So maybe it wouldn't matter so much for this particular story to come in. I don't know. But you've got to have a little bit of a step up being from the area.
Well, that was at least how I, like, I mean, I don't know. I'm not one of these people mm-hmm. who thinks, like, because you are something or of something, you have, like, a claim to that story. But I did think...
You still have to deserve it, maybe,
yeah,
but
you
it does give you...
Absolutely.
Right, right.
But it does make things easier and quicker sometimes.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, I definitely thought, like, it was certainly something I could say to people who might fund me, because I couldn't... The way I wanted to do it, I couldn't just go down and start shooting. I wanted a crew and to do it right. And so I was... I went to the Peabody Awards for the Order of Myths with a proposal in hand and walked up to ITVS and said, this is happening. Like, please send me down right now. And they did. To their credit, yes. Mm-hmm. Like, along with, like, CineReach and the Sundance Institute and Chicken and Egg and a little bit later, the Tribeca Film Institute. Like, people just kind of put their money together and got me down there.
Yeah, that's a great...
In a week.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you already have relationships with some of these organizations.
Not all of them.
But not all of them.
Mm-mm.
But it helps once you have a couple in your pocket to go to the others and look, this is happening. You can get on now.
Yeah.
Or you can miss the boat.
Oh, that wasn't the tone at all. It was please.
Yeah.
But I was getting a Peabody with ITVS, so I thought if there's ever a time to approach a funder, it's when you're getting an award together.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Making an environmental documentary, even though this is kind of more than an environmental documentary, just happens to be an environmental disaster that occurred, but it's kind of, it seems like it's more about a corrupt way of handling the issue. In other words, I don't know that your story would have even been that compelling had it been for the fact that if these people would just, the corporations would just sort of do the right thing to begin with and do what is necessary from the beginning rather than waiting afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, that may be people, they'd have less of a PR problem. I mean, part of the thing about seeing this is getting pissed off at these, you know, all the those guys in their suits standing in front of Congress, a hearing.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you know, we all love to hate. In other words, they're easy targets on some levels. But in you know, they're rich men behaving poorly. The reaction and then trying to cover up as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even which guy was it that was being very, very vocal, very sort of ad dynamic, and
who says when we're not equipped to deal with this.
Yeah,
Rex Tillerson.
He tried brutal honesty.
Yeah,
and see how that went over. And
yeah. I mean, I feel like
we're not
going
to be able to help
that.
You out. You can take this now.
Oh no, that was. I think you're talking about. Are you talking about the scene with Ken Feinberg when he says, "Take this, it's a gift."
Yes.
That's like in a. That's like in a scene where he's speaking to like seafood workers at a town hall meeting.
Okay.
It's not
yes.
Thinking
okay,
like
that's
that.
The one I'm talking
Different.
About. That guy. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's like he got hired by BP to like allocate funds for reparations, and he did it for a while.
I see.
So yeah.
But and getting to the local folks, by the way, I mean one of the startling images for me was when they were trying again a kind of a botched PR job or it seems like it was the result of a botched PR job where they're hiring local shrimpers what do they call them shrimp trawlers or to help clean up and they don't have equipment for they have nets which
right
oil doesn't get captured by nets, you know, usually maybe mesh, but not a net, right?
No, I mean, it's so funny because when we were interviewing that guy, he was like, this doesn't work. But, I mean, it was also kind of, like, crazy because here BP comes in and, like, drops oil, like, where they work. And they're, I mean, I think in a way they had to hire those people to do the work because they were out of work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're told not to talk to the media when they're probably so angry at BP for creating the situation in the first place and then to be muzzled. So it was interesting because, like, all those people, like, we would talk to people and they would be like, we can't talk to you. We're going to get fired. But they wanted to talk. Like, they did not like the situation they were in. They weren't, like, they were angry, you know.
Sure. Well, so, their livelihoods.
Yeah.
And of course, their...
They were in such a bad bind.
And their homes. They, like you say, it was pristine.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then it's like, you know, it's just horrible. They're screwed. I'm real fascinated, though, by how you were able to harness all this, all these different funding organizations behind you so quickly.
It's just when a disaster like that happens.
They get it.
I mean, I think, like, that's never happened to me before. Certainly not. I mean, I just think, like, that was such a weird circumstance. I think, I mean, it wasn't like they gave me, like, a huge amount of money, but it wasn't like enough to fund the whole movie. Certainly it was enough to go for 2 weeks and shoot and edit that.
Oh, and then you would have something.
Yeah.
You can use
to
get other funding.
To get it like going in a real way with the right crew, with like the right way to do it. No, I mean, sure. It was like cheap and dirty, but like I had a whole crew and I could hire a real editor. So it was such a gift actually.
Sure. Were you able to get, I don't know, like environmental groups, did they end up coming in with any kind of, they didn't have any money, right?
I mean, I didn't even ask. Like, no. I didn't really, it happened so quick. It was more like, who do we know that we can ask? And it was also like these organizations said, well, maybe you can ask them. And like, what do you need? I mean, people were really trying to help at that moment. Like, I mean, that was when the camera, there was that shot on the nightly news every night of the well just going. And was that during that time, like people... I mean, I think they probably felt the same kind of desire as I did to, like, do something. And so I think, like, it wasn't just me.
Yes.
It was all those organizations were like, well, yeah, let's do this, you know?
And how many millions of gallons did it turn out to be? And it took over 3 months for them to
I don't stop remember
the,
that. Like, I would have known at South
it's
By
okay.
when we just
is
finished.
Is that where you had your premiere?
It
your
premiered
U.S.
South
premiere
by.
Or world
yep.
premiere?
It premiered at world premiere, yeah.
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 I missed South By this past year.
Yeah.
Because I was working or something
yeah.
annoying.
It was a good South By.
Was it?
Well, in certain ways, there was also
Oh, your
film
was there.
Yeah, yeah, my film was there.
What were you going to say?
Oh, well, there was this accident. Did you hear about the accident where the
yes.
guy, like, yeah, so that
backed
was...
Backed into
was,
a public a group
yeah,
in the nearby
yeah, so
near
that
the
was,
convention
that
center?
Definitely was not... I mean, that happened kind of after film was over, but it was just a real awful
yeah.
thing.
No, I know. I did read about it
yeah.
as it was going on. And, yeah, bizarre.
Very.
Right? And then since then, have you been showing it in a lot of festivals, or did you have a deal made up already? I assume you're going to have... I know you're going to a theatrical.
Radius is doing it.
Right. And then is there a broadcast set up?
There's going to... It's not set in stone, but PBS and Pivot are doing the TV.
If you get money from ITVS like you did, is that kind of... They're thinking, we're probably going to put this on PBS. Is that
I think,
a natural just sort of connection to make, or is
I mean, you should ask them because I don't actually know.
Okay.
But I mean, I guess I always assumed, I mean, I had Order of Myths was on PBS, and I like that because everyone watches PBS, and so it's like, it's kind of cool. Like when we were making this movie, we'd be walking down the beach in Alabama and people would be like, who are you? Are you a filmmaker? And I would say I made that movie and people would have seen it. And I just think like, cause everyone watches PBS. So that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. I just heard a little of your Southern.
The Southern. Yeah. I'm tired too. Moving.
Is that more when you're tired, right?
Yeah, it does. Tired or drinking. Comes
okay.
Back.
I'll remember that. Tell me, growing up in Alabama, did you, were you already, I mean, I don't know what your parents did, but when did you find film? Did you go to school and then trip into it, or?
Well, my dad actually, when I was super little, worked for the oil industry. He was a landman for the oil industry, but my dad, as I was growing up, he more was involved in commercial real estate, but what he mostly did was country songwriting. Like he wrote Every Which Way But Loose, and
Song?
Yeah, the song Every Which Way But Loose.
Oh, that's true. There's another film, by the way, connection to the music, mm-hmm. right? You did a music doc about singer songwriter.
Yeah.
That movie, by the way, I want to, and then we'll get back to your father because I'm curious how you came into filmmaking. Very touching film in that. Correct me if I got the right film, right? There's a scene, he's at home. Again, this is all through archival footage.
Not all of it.
Okay.
Of Towns, so, yeah.
Of Towns, excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes, he's been dead for a while, right? But you had people that reflecting on their relationships, right, and about him. But in the archival footage of him, there's one scene where, is he living in a trailer home with his girlfriend?
Yes.
And there's a neighbor, an older African-American guy, Uncle Seymour, comes in. I'm getting emotional talking about it. Actually, it's weird. That hit me from nowhere. But there's a beautiful scene where he's listening to Towns play the guitar and sing, and he just starts to cry.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most, it's an incredible moment, you know, and that's, yeah, I know that's not your footage.
No, it's from a great film called Heartworn Highways
that
Jim Zalapsky made.
That's maybe what I was thinking about when it was all archived.
I mean, Jim Zalapsky, he made a movie about, like,
somebody had to
outlaw
shoot
country in the 70s, yeah. And okay. And he just, we met up with him, we were making the movie, and he said, you can just use whatever you want.
Wow, that's nice. Well, that's nice, and it's great that you included that, because then maybe more people got to see it. It's a great moment in that film, and, it's very, very powerful.
He was a cool guy.
I enjoyed that. I'm, of course, interested in Towns Van Zandt, you know, in his story and his music. And he's probably best known for Poncho and Lefty, right? I'm sorry. So your dad was a songwriter?
Yeah, my dad was a country songwriter.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the trajectory there in terms of oil and real estate
and
songwriting?
I think it's just like, how can I make money in Alabama? It's probably the trajectory. But I think he always wanted to be a songwriter and, you know, was working for his dad and never really got to be. And then like kind of late in his young life, he just said, I'm going to do this and started and sent a song to Ernest Tubb, and Ernest Tubb called him, you know, so that was his first song, was an Ernest Tubb song that he sent him cold. So I think in the way that relates to me is like, it was kind of hard for my dad to be an artist, and he was so supportive of me being an artist. Like I never, like when I got into graduate film school at NYU, and I remember I was excited, you know, I got like almost a full ride and I was happy. My dad was like 80 times as excited as I was.
Oh, yeah. And so he was pride. He had pride in there too.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and so I think like some people, like I remember going to school and people were like, yeah, like my parents want me to do this or that. Like my parents always were like, this is great that you're a filmmaker. I guess that was kind of unusual, especially in Alabama when I didn't even know growing up that that could be a career.
So how did you find out?
I mean, I was in school, undergrad, and I was like a poetry major, and I just started getting interested in like, what's the limit of language and how does that translate to images? And I started making these like short experimental films and stuff like that. That's how it started.
Where was that though? Where'd
at Brown.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a great school to go to. So you must have done well in high school.
What?
You must have been a good student.
Well, I think not many people apply to Brown from Alabama, so I think I had a leg up.
Oh, that's not a good...
It's true, trust me. Okay. I was sort of the only person who applied from Alabama, you know.
Well, it's great that you found film. You're making great documentaries.
Oh, thanks.
Sure. Where is it playing here in New York? It's playing...
It's going to be playing at the Village East. It's opening there. Okay. I don't know where else it'll go after that here. But
at the Village East, right, on the
13th?
Is it Friday the... October
13th? It's opening the 29th of October. In about
a little over two weeks,
yeah.
I'm usually, it sounds sad to try to defend myself.
Oh, my God.
I'm usually a little bit more organized.
I just ate all this candy and I'm cracked. Look at this, you're crashing.
Opening on Wednesday the 29th?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wednesday the 29th here in New York City at the Village East Cinema. And then is it opening in
LA Sunset 5?
A week later or is it the same day? Same day. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it going to play in Alabama is the question.
Yeah, it's playing a lot of southern cities. We're doing kind of. The oil belt.
The oil belt.
Yeah.
Great. Well, hopefully we'll get a few more listeners from there, too.
I hope so.
You know, but I hope people discover The Great Invisible, directed by Margaret Brown, who edited the film.
It started with Jeff Richman, and then a little director named Terrence Malick hired him away.
Don't know him.
and then Robin Schwartz came on, who I made most of the movie with, and then Tyler Hubby helped us kind of get to the finish line.
And who shot it?
Another triad. Jeffrey Pichot was the main shooter, and then...
Sounds local.
Sorry?
Sounds local. By that last name.
Yeah, it's Portuguese.
Oh.
And then Adam Stone, who shoots a lot for Jeff Nichols, shot a lot of it, and so did Jody Lee Lipes.
Oh, right, Jody. I knew there was a name in your inner crew that I knew.
Yeah, Jody.
I know he's done a lot of cinematography, and he has that Ballet 422, I think.
Yeah.
I saw that at
cool.
at Tribeca last year, or earlier this year, I should say. It was delightful to meet you.
Delightful to meet
and
you.
And I hope to run into you again soon.
Yeah, yeah. Now, next time without red microphones.
Right. And also, I'll have bright, like, orange ones instead. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm going to lay it out there. I was pretty exhausted. That's all I can say. I mean, but she was great. And she had to move out of this apartment, and she was desperately trying to find a moving company. All this going on, and then we were both. Oh, and when I was supposed to go to meet her at the offices of, I think we met at Synetic. What happened was I got into a terrible traffic in my taxi, and I couldn't get there on time. So I ended up having to shuffle things around, but I got back to there later. But I was pretty exhausted from all the running around I was doing that afternoon. But it was still, when I met Margaret, oh my goodness, I had a great, great time. She was so lovely and so smart and so talented a filmmaker. So it was all turned out rather well. Okay, next up here, Jeremy Workman. The film is called Magical Universe, and it's a very personal story that he and his girlfriend encountered and experienced and lived through with this very unique, eccentric artist from Maine. Let's just named Al Carby. But we talk about it in great detail. So this is primarily a conversation with Jeremy, but Chuck Workman is also featured on this particular segment of Filmwax Radio. So let's tune into that right now.
Several years ago, a young filmmaker and his girlfriend randomly met a very strange artist living alone in a giant house in a small town in Maine.
Introduce yourself. What's your name?
Albert Nicholson Carby.
They became his closest friends.
Hey, Al. Merry Christmas, Al.
He sent tons of letters to them, hours of home movies, and piles of artwork. And this went on for over a decade.
Sound weird?
No.
Is
This is Mermaid Bobby, see? And I built this, whatever it is. These are my books from spirit writing, where I'm in touch with the universe. But nobody likes to read it because they have to turn upside down and everything.
There's this gaping entrance that leads into this massive cave. It blew my mind.
This is a story about Al Kabi. And it has taken me to many wondrous places. Every time you fall asleep, you wake up in another world, another reality. I wake up every day, see, so I come back with all this adventure.
What do you think?
I don't know. Start of something big, maybe?
Magical Universe.
Well, we have a unique situation where we have a filmmaker in the room who actually grew up in a family where there was editing and filmmaking going on. And that, I'm just curious, Jeremy, did you go through a rebellious period where you said, I'm never going to do what this guy does? Or, I mean, describe your story in terms of growing up with a famous documentary father and then finding your own way. End of question, I guess.
I mean, I was certainly exposed to this kind of filmmaking at a very early age. Mm-hmm. So not only you were making films, sometimes involving subjects that I was part of. There was a Little League baseball thing that you were doing. I was, you know.
That was my first documentary. Yeah.
So your first documentary was a profile of my...
Of your Little League team.
Right.
I'll tell you, I had made these commercial documentaries, yeah, like I said, but then I had never made one that was just for itself. So I said, I better make one, because it was, whatever the year was, I was moderating some documentary thing at the LA Film Festival. So we made this film of your Little League, and you were great in it.
I still remember. It was my heyday. So that was probably my first exposure to that. But I also, I think it was just seeing that being made, sort of following how it was being made, watching you filming it, where there was cameras now following our team, then seeing that process where you were editing it, and then seeing the finished product. You know, being exposed to that from a very early age, it was definitely something that was super, super exciting. And I think even leading through my high school and into college, I was very closely monitoring or involved with different documentary projects of yours.
Right.
Superstar, I'm in.
You're in most of my films, and I put you in Magician, actually, where was that? Rochester? Eastman House, right? They revived a film, you know. So there was no reason to put him in. I just felt it was good luck.
It's the Hitchcock cameo, your version of the Hitchcock cameo.
He's in a lot of the films that and brought me good luck in those.
Yeah, you'll have to excuse us. I'm sort of passing the mic between the two of us.
Right.
But so Superstar, I'm in. It's during a scene when you talk about Andy going to Hollywood and there's somebody selling Hollywood star maps, and I was in one of those shots.
Okay.
The Source, the Beat Generation film, I'm also in. It was, you were shooting Hunter Thompson speaking at NYU, and I was part of the audience listening. And then actually after, a story that I often tell is I went to go get his licensing document signed, and I had to go into Hunter Thompson's limo, and he offered me a joint. And he refused to sign it, I think.
Well, I hope you had the joint of this.
Yes, and there was a number of strange interactions I had on that movie, The Source, where I was sort of PAing. But so from a very early age, I was exposed to documentary filmmaking,
right,
to this kind of editing that Chuck is known for. I think I was working for you and doing a lot of editing at a very early age. So There was, in my case, there was never a question of doing something else. I knew instantly that this was something that I wanted to do. What, you know, why do anything else? And
wow. So
I,
he did, when you were having your bar mitzvah, your dad ran off.
Yes.
To Israel to have his own religious Jesus. I don't
No, I just meant that year, that particular year, yes, is when I did the Israel film, which wasn't very good, although I like it. And whenever I play it at a film festival, people say, does that really go on the air? I mean, do you really show that? But I like it. It taught me. It taught me a lot, you know, just making that and the Little League film. And then finally, after a while, you kind of get the idea, you know. The thing about Jeremy, that when he was making these films, his earlier films, is that it's great for a father to see your children do what you do. My daughter's also a television producer, and she just sort of does what I do. But they're also good at it. I mean, he makes very good films. So that was like an extra thing. So
it's a little bonus. Anyway. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of genetically engineered to be an editor.
That's a good way to put it.
And, you know, fortunately, have been able to do it. I do a number of editing. I do a lot of movie trailers besides the filmmaking that I do, which I also edit everything. So I was definitely, like I said, sort of genetically engineered to be sort of a robo editor. And I started very early.
robo editor.
You know, I was editing stuff kind of under your eye, probably 20, maybe before that, you know. So certainly got exposed to it very early. I mean, I had some of my first professional editing jobs at around 20, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I hope my own kid has this. As even if the path isn't necessarily any guarantee towards riches, but to have that sort of knowledge about yourself must be nice. I mean, then you're stuck with having to make documentaries.
Yeah.
For the next 50, 60 years.
And by the way, we don't always agree on films at all.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping you'd get into...
When I say we don't always, we rarely agree on films. Right. the masters, we like the same masters, but a lot of the basic films that you know, we disagree on. And so it's not a question of even just being alike. It's a question of each having our own kind of taste and developing it in a certain way.
Now, interesting. One thing I would add to that is I think I maybe have a little bit more mainstream taste than you.
I think you do. Yeah.
Okay, but yeah. I would also maybe argue that I get that mainstream taste from having developed a sense that I learned from you, which is that audiences are very important. And that you're not making a film for yourself, that you really have to think about audience at all time. And that is something that I think I picked up from you.
Well, I certainly believe that. I mean, I think you do have to think about the audience, and you have to reach out to the audience. And but you also have to have a lot of confidence in the audiences if you're going to do anything kind of interesting. So in Jeremy's film, it's not necessarily something that an audience would run to, but yet the audiences all love it. So there must be something within the film of Magical Universe that he did that is finding the audience. And what I think both his style and my style, what we do have in common is the audience wants to watch it. The audience really wants to keep their eye on the screen. They don't want to miss anything. And there's lots of things happening that we choose to put in the films that are not passive things. So the audience can't be too passive either. And even in doing all the stuff, I worked on a lot of Oscar shows, I still felt that I wanted the audience to reach out a little bit more to me. I didn't want them to just be sitting there and, you know, with one eye looking at the television, you know. So it's not a question of making the audience work hard. It's just engaging the audience the way we would go to a sports event and be very engaged in a really good game, you know, or read a good book, but it's not necessarily just entertainment. It's something that we're thinking about constantly as these things roll over us.
And yeah, I also think that's really like a defining kind of trait of your style, which is, you know, there was something that I remember that I always remember, which is, you know, I don't remember what film you were talking about, but where you don't want the audience to even feel like they could, you know, go out for popcorn or just leave the theater for a second, even to the point where you don't even want the audience to take a breath. And that's sort of something that I think about whether I'm editing stuff short form like movie trailers or editing features like Magical right. Universe, you know, right. where you're really thinking hard about where is the audience in this story?
Where's the takeaway? Where's the way in? All these things, right? Because it's maybe...
The only other thing I'd add to that is that you're working for clients who don't necessarily agree with that. So they say, can you make it a little more easier to digest?
Musical and numbers.
Whatever. No, it's not just that. It's just in the style.
Yeah. Yeah,
that and you want to say to them, you know, like anybody would say, oh, they'll get it. Don't worry. Yeah. But the point is they do get it.
Right.
But especially the commercial cinema, they don't always understand right. that the audience can get so much more.
Right. If it weren't for those early D.W. Griffiths and the early forefathers who like decided to do a cut from one scene to another and started to, you know, help the audience engage them, as you put it, and you want to lead them along to some degree at the same time, because you know that once they will get it and that they'll be grateful for it in the long run. But yeah, Duke sometimes have to take them into uncomfortable territory or something they're just not used to. And I guess you have to do that with your...
You do, and not only that, it's very difficult, and yeah, I think it's held films back. Held the cinema back in that, okay, this is it, so that they much rather make a McDonald's hamburger that's easy to go down than something that's, you know, a little more complicated.
Yeah.
And what you do is you can make the most entertaining film, you know, that you can think of, and there will still be people that say, yeah, it's great, but isn't it this? You say, yeah, but... Then you just say it was great.
Right.
So,
and by the way, you can't win because then you know, like if you're Godard, you're on one end of the spectrum. Where can you imagine being in those early screenings of Breathless? But then again, even Spielberg, who is always cited as being, you know, goes down easy, is relentlessly criticized for that. And then when you know he does decide, okay, this one's for it, my critics, you know, you have the sense that he's making those movies for his critics instead of just. Which I'm sure he doesn't give a shit about, but
and also to add, I mean, you know,
he does. Okay, that's fair.
You know, for documentary film, there's also this sort of, you know, bias or prejudice going into documentary films that documentary films should look a certain way. They should be, you know, edifying, or they should be sort of in a PBS style that people are used to seeing documentaries a certain way. So to sort of break out of that tradition immediately poses challenges for audiences or for engaging audiences that, you know, most people are used to documentaries acting a certain way.
Right.
Then that also as a documentary filmmaker and certainly with my dad, you know, it's always, I'm sure it's always been a challenge when you're trying to sort of push that envelope a little bit.
Well, let's talk about Magical Universe because, you know, for one thing, it's your new film and second, it's coming out soon. And
it is coming out at IFC Center on October 31st, and it'll also be in Los Angeles at Arena Cinemas, and it'll be at a few other theaters regionally across the country, and it's being released by IFC Films.
Was your sense that, you know, your subject is Al Carby, who is this main resident, who a venerable man, who is something I guess people would describe as eccentric. He lives in a converted barn where he has amassed this art that he's created, usually involving Barbie dolls, for one thing. So I was trying to condense it a little bit, the synopsis, just to move things along. But
oh, it's unusual.
It is. It is. You know. But if you're deep in this documentary, you know, viewing audience, you may have seen a couple of eccentrics similar to Al. He's not alone in the world, but he is alone in his own world. But there are other people like him that are out there in the world, and it's so delightful to really get a sense of this one, Al. And I was wondering, you kind of met him, you and your now wife, right?
Still my girlfriend.
I'm sorry. Yes,
yeah,
that ring is not on the finger.
But we've been together for quite a long time.
Okay. Yes. So and anyway, the two of you are Jesse. You're on a vacation in Maine,
exactly.
And a friend of yours says, you know, while you're in Maine, you should go visit this guy Al Carby. He's not too far. He's in Saco, Maine, or whatever. And so, and then next thing you know, this is somebody not only you become friends with, but 10 years later, you make you've put out a documentary about him. So.
Yeah, essentially, I mean, it's a very strange story. It's essentially this outsider artist, which is how you would sort of classify Al. You know, you'd kind of classify him like, though, you know, Henry Darger, who was also the subject of a great documentary called In the Realms of the Unreal. Mm-hmm. Al Carby is an outsider artist. He, you know, he's living alone in Maine in his house. He spends all day making artwork. He makes collages and dioramas, most of which have Barbie dolls in them. So my girlfriend Astrid and I were on vacation in Maine, and very randomly, mm-hmm. it was suggested that we swing by, and we went into his home and met him and started filming him. I started filming him with a handy cam, you know, a what would probably be like $100 camera.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and this started this very, very strange friendship between me and this 88-year-old man that went on for years. Where
when it did start off, he was in his 80s, or it,
yeah, he so was he was 83 okay. when right. when we okay. when we met him, and okay. this went on for, you know, years, and yeah, and basically it became this story of this relation, this very unlikely relationship between this artist in Maine and this couple in New York City. And at one point, Al, kind of inspired by me filming him, he gets his own video camera, and he gets it at the Salvation Army. It's a VHS video camera, an old RCA video okay. camera that you hold, put on your shoulder. He buys it for $25, and he starts filming his life and sending videos to us. And then we take those videos, and we start making videos to him. And suddenly, we're in this very strange pen pal world with this artist in Maine, this yeah. Barbie doll obsessed artist in Maine, and slowly start becoming his only link to the world. And this goes on for years. It's very hard to describe the movie. And, you know, certainly people are like, oh, it's the documentary on the Barbie doll, the old Barbie doll artist. But, it, you know, that, and that's certainly a way to, that we look at it, but it has a lot of other things that, you know, it, kind of does, and it does in a different way. You know, I'm in it, so it's a personal yes. documentary right. where me and my girlfriend Astrid are in it.
This is a subgenre of the personal documentary, though, is the personal documentary about connecting with someone who this is essentially the primary subject of the documentary.
Yeah,
there's like a subcategory where
yeah, it's almost know, like a subcat.
I make these films, but all of a sudden I got sucked into the story, and I can't leave myself out because it is part of the story.
Yeah, and that seems a bit like you see that more and more now. It seems yeah. you know, and I don't know whether it's
might be just to the sheer quantity of documentaries.
Sure,
you know,
it could also
hey, I know
be.
An interesting person, so.
I think it's also probably a little bit about just, you know, the times we live in mm. that it's mm. you know, people are. Those sort of rules of self-reflexivity or rules of the fourth wall or right. whatever that is yeah. have kind of gotten broken down a little
yeah,
bit, whether
true.
It's because of YouTube or Vimeo or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Though it seems like a lot of those restrictions have gotten broken down. So, mm-hmm. you know, when I was making this movie, it wasn't a big deal for me to say, okay, there's going to be a scene where the movie turns on itself and you're going to see Astrid, my girlfriend, watching the movie.
Right.
And people have seen that before, but it's not that, you know, these days it's not that out of the box, you know.
I actually think that happened in Grey Gardens.
Yes.
Watching the film before it's finished. And
yeah, and you've there's
been, a few, yeah.
you know, there's other documentaries on subjects where they watch yeah. the movie and they, you know, respond to how their yeah. the reaction.
I think they have Snowden. I think Snowden is watching himself
yes.
on CNN or something in a
oh,
new
for
film.
Sure. Right in Citizen 4 you're
yeah.
referring to.
And also, of course, Mick Jagger was watching the
Gimme Shelter.
Gimme Shelter, yeah.
Good, good references. Chuck, you're interested in documentaries?
Pardon me? Am I in?
Do
I
go kidding around. Are there young documentaries while on the subject that you're especially, I don't know, Laura, you mentioned Laura Poitras and...
Yeah, well, I keep up with it.
You do.
I mean,
you
know, as I said, I ran two different screenings of that, and I taught for 3 years recently. Mm. So I do keep up with it.
Yeah.
And I can see what the students like and what younger people like and what older people like, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff happening in documentary.
You're also have it's a neat perspective because you're also teaching documentary to to college students. So it's a you're probably seeing a sort of how this newer generation is approaching as well.
Yeah, yeah, often
also what their response to. Yeah,
they are always looking for subjects. It's very hard. They end up they have somebody interesting in their family. Oh, my Uncle Joe, he was in the Army, and he used to always tell us about World War II. I'm going to do a documentary about him. And I said, what? And they don't really know what. You know, they just think that that's kind of interesting. So
it could be short. It often is, right?
They are short. They're not always short enough. But there's some, you know, there's some just some very good filmmakers who are now, who might have going to Hollywood or making narrative films are now making documentaries and perfectly happy about it. I mean, they don't feel that they're cheating anyway. They like it's fun to make a documentary because you don't have to figure out what the scenery looks like. It's what was there, but you end up changing it anyway. One of the things I think that I wanted to mention was that Jeremy, I think, can see even from the Little League film, he may not even have thought about this, is manipulation. And so if I did a film about his Little League and he was 13 or 14, and I would ask them, show me how you throw a curve or something. And it was not verite at all. It was a totally set up kind of a thing.
Right.
And I think more and more filmmakers are doing that. If they're honest, if they're truthful scenes, then there's a certain amount of setting up that you do in a documentary. And I think that that's, as much as I love verite, I think that that's even more interesting in many ways.
Well, also, I mean, you know, clearly, Jeremy, you make a living with your commercial work, but that you the idea of doing a portrait where you have no idea when it's going to end is, or, you know, could have a 10-year span of a timeline like Magical Universe does.
Well, you know, but another...
You'd have to be. You can't make a living that way.
Yeah, of course. And you know, that's certainly a side project that you know was just I was doing on the side, and you even see me in the film making the movie on the side in the middle of the night at one point. But the other thing I was going to mention about that film was about sort of an editing sort of structural thing, which gets to a little what you were talking about. Structure and editing style and manipulation sounds a little negative, but it's sort of manipulating the material. It's a structural thing, which is, you know, with Magical Universe, I really wanted it to be a movie where you started your opinion on the subject matter one way, and by the end of the movie, it had changed entirely.
Okay, well, yeah, elaborate, because I was thinking before while we were talking about Al that I was wondering how protective you became of him, because of his eccentricities, and particularly with Barbie dolls. One could say this is a really creepy person, but that's really being superficial.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people said, well, what is your take on Al Carby, the subject of the movie? And basically my take over many years was that I sort of started my opinion about him one way, where I thought he was strange and creepy and something weird was going on. Is this deviant? You know, here's this old man.
Am I
going
to follow him down to the basement?
Yeah, exactly. Like here's this old man with Barbie dolls. He lives alone. He's obsessed with my girlfriend, Astrid. This is really weird. But by the end of my relationship with him, we had sort of come totally full circle. And we had started to realize, you know that he was actually, you know, he's actually some sort of, you know, visionary artist. You know, you may not like his art, but he, without a doubt, he is some sort of visionary artist. So it was really one of my goals was that that went on over 10 years for me, right? That transition, that arc of my opinion about this guy happened over maybe a decade. Yeah. So I wanted the same exact arc to happen for an audience in 80 minutes as I had for 10 years. So that was sort of a goal going in, that it wasn't going to be a movie where I just was going to keep going and going. I really wanted to create the exact same story, that character kind of, you saw someone one way at the beginning, and by the end it had completely turned on you, and you didn't really even know that it had happened.
And that was a goal.
Mission accomplished, you know. It's also was very interesting to see a portrait of an artist who wasn't even aware, like he almost was doing something completely out of a sense of, you know, like there wasn't an intellectual or a deliberate. I mean, that could be also be superficial a way of describing it on my part, but it's as almost as though this was just acting out of instincts in terms of what he was creating, and there was no master plan for this. I mean, he's the opposite of Andy Warhol, you know,
Andy
Warhol in this sense.
He would, you know, if I didn't walk into his door that day, and in some ways completely change his life,
right? Yeah,
you know, he would have still. See, he'd still be doing the exact same thing that he was doing, you know, 10 years before, 20 years before, 30 years before,
right.
Which was just making his art. Right. And that's what really, you know, that's what made him happy. And that's what kept him going. And you know, we were talking before and, you know, or it seemed like Orson in his late years was kind of continually making these movies, and it wasn't for the purpose where he was, you know, he had already had this incredible filmography. He had already achieved the highest levels of making movies, but now he was just sort of making movies because that's what he does.
Mm.
And so there was always, you know, for me, that kind of connection also relates to Al Carby in, you know, obviously completely different artist,
mm-hmm.
you know, completely different kind of person, but he's making his art for him alone. And he doesn't care what anyone thinks, and he doesn't care, you know, if he has any recognition. This is what he's doing, and that was inspiring.
I just want to add that I think that a lot of these subject matters, whether it's Orson Welles or Al Carby or Andy Warhol, they're outsiders. I mean, they are outsiders, and they. One of the interesting things about making a documentary is you really get to explore them. And the obvious thing that you think about, whether it's some old man shooting Barbie dolls, which, by the way, Jeremy's girlfriend and the mother of my grandchildren supported him, defended him, said, no, he wasn't some dirty old man. He was an interesting man, you know, all through that process, because we kept bringing it up. But all of these characters, you think of Welles as some fat guy, and you think of this guy as, you know, a pervert. And when you do a documentary and you spend the time and the audience spends the time, and if you do it with some truth and some integrity, you really reveal something interesting. And yes, there are creeps and perverts and fat guys, you know, all over the place. But in these particular cases, and if you think about a lot of other documentaries, you know, subjects of Earl Morris's, subjects of Werner Herzog's, this Indonesian film last year that was so about
Act of Killing.
Yeah, Act of Killing about killers. I mean, you say you go beyond the layer. You're constantly peeling the onion and looking beyond them and beyond them. That's what in Magical Universe you do get that. You get that feeling. Oh, look at that guy. He's what a weird guy. But yet, what every once in a while also you register with him. You say, oh, I see what he's doing. And you get it. And that's another thing about a good documentary is that brings you that. And you walk out of it after you're done. You know, the old thing is, well, what did I learn from this? You know, Gene Siskel, that was always his thing. I want to learn something from a documentary.
Mm.
That's not always that important. But you do learn in a kind of a subtextual way, in a subconscious way, about these characters. And if the film works, but it's... You have to be a careful filmmaker to do that.
Magician, sure. The astonishing work and life of Orson Welles, is coming out in December, or when is it coming out?
It opens in New York at Lincoln Plaza December 12th, and also in L.A. in December, and then it plays, I believe, in around the country beginning in February.
Right on the heels, practically, of Magical Universe having its New York and L.A. premiere on October 31st. Halloween?
October 31st in New York, November 7th.
November, a week later in L.A. At the L.A. Independent?
November in different places in the country.
Where in L.A.? Do we know the theater?
Yes, the Arena Cinemas.
The Arena Cinemas. Thank you. Did you have something to add?
No, I just want to say Jeremy's first film was played with a short of mine 20 years ago, I guess. Almost. Called Who Was Henry Jaglom, which was a feature-length documentary. And it played with a 10-minute short of mine at LA Film Festival. AFI, yeah.
Wow.
And I used to have the poster, but my wife made me throw it away.
What?
She said, you have too much junk. I think I snuck it into storage, though. But that was fun. And this has happened more than once, where we're coincidentally working on at the same time about something else, you know. So I hope it continues.
Well, I'm glad.
And yeah, he's done the trailer on a lot of my films.
Right. Yeah. I hope it continues, too, so I can bring you both back on again.
Awesome.
Next time around. Thank you both. It was great to sit with you both. Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There you go. And Chuck, again, I don't know if you heard it, but we'll put up the Chuck part in a few weeks. But Chuck's film is coming out, I believe, in December. So we have a little time before that happens. And around that time, I'll put up the whole show, too, probably on the main website, filmwaxradio.com. So, okay, now last up here, or kind of last, because we have Jacqueline at the very end. But coming up in this now, in this third segment of this episode, is Monsieur Jean-Yves Olivier. The untold story behind history, a well-kept secret behind the worldwide icon, Nelson Mandela, was released. The story, which is largely unknown, about Nelson Mandela's release is what makes the documentary Plot for Peace for the first time. Heads of state, generals, diplomats, master spies, and anti-apartheid figures reveal how Africa's frontline states helped end apartheid. This improbable key to Mandela's prison cell was a mysterious French businessman dubbed Monsieur Jacques in classified correspondence. His trade secret? Trust. Anyway, that I, of course, read off of the website, but I didn't think I could put it any better than that. It's a real spellbounding story. And there are people that were like, you know, deathly enemies that appear side by side in this documentary. But I didn't have access to the director, Carlos Aguilo, but or the director of photography, Diego Olivier, but I did get to speak to Jean-Yves. So this is my conversation with the commodities broker and diplomat. And now a filmmaker, I guess, Jean-Yves Olivier.
The new South Africa has to eliminate the racial hatred and offer guarantees to all.
Nelson Mandela a gagné. L'ex-prisonnier va devenir président. Il va libérer le pays de l'apartheid de son enfermement. C'est ça l'histoire avec un grand H. Une histoire qui est en fait la somme de beaucoup de petites histoires. Dont la mienne. Avec mes amis, dans les pays de la ligne de front, nous avons fait taire les armes pour que l'apartheid puisse mourir en paix.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Enchanté.
Enchanté.
Thank you. I've almost run out of my French. We're almost there. Je m'appelle Adam Chartoff.
And I'm Jean-Yves Olivier.
Again, thank you. And this documentary, which is about you and the specific period of time which started, I guess, in the mid-80s, it sounds like, even though you started going to South Africa before that, you started figuring things out, right, in the mid-80s and how to...
My first visit to South Africa was 81.
Right.
I remember very well, July 81, so you see. Mm-hmm. And normally I don't have memories of... I don't remember dates or names, but that was such an experience that I remember the time. And since 81, I did visit on a regular basis South Africa, yes. Never for too long stay, but except when I did the exchange of prisoner. But up to now, I'm a regular visitor of South Africa.
To this day?
Yeah.
Let's go back a little bit. You were raised to a certain point, of course, which is part of my question, but you were raised in your formative years in Algeria.
Yes,
most of your childhood until the revolution.
Exactly. I am born in Algeria, but from French descendant. Or French. My father was born in France, so it was what we used to call a pied noir, black feet. I we stay in Algeria until the independence of Algeria in 1962, where I was 17 years old, where we have to live, all of us, 1 million, totality of the of my community has to live.
More or less overnight.
3 months.
Yeah.
1 million.
In the scheme of things, it's almost, it feels like that, right? And start over, create an all-new sense of identity and home.
Yes, you are losing. You lose. We lost our ground. We lost our home. We lose our roots. We became nomads.
And then, were you living in Paris?
No. I was very when I was in Paris, and if you recall in the movie Plot for Peace, I have been arrested because I was in favor of French Algeria.
Oh, right.
And I was 17. So when I get out of jail, I couldn't bear
to go there
to remain in France.
Understood.
So I migrate to UK.
Okay.
To learn English. Try to learn. I don't think the result is very good, but let's try.
and obviously pursued an education. Right?
No, I had no education at all. I left.
Is that true?
I have no diploma, nothing.
Nothing.
I am totally.
So it's all by your wit.
Yeah.
But including your career in business as well as that of diplomacy.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. What do you owe that to?
Sorry?
What do you owe this to? I mean, how does that something like that happen? Where
it was a normal process for me. Uh-huh. I had to work because my family had no money, so okay. I had to work very early. I couldn't be, education, even if it's free, like in France, there is a cost involved. They were refugees; they left Algeria with nothing, mm-hmm. So I couldn't be. I didn't want to be a burden on my family, so I have to start to do something to make my own money.
What did your father do in Algeria?
He was an engineer, mm-hmm. and he lost his job when we left Algeria and never found a new job.
At some point, you entered the finance world.
Yes, finance,
I mean,
the commodity
I guess,
world.
Commodities.
The commodities.
Commodities, yeah.
Which is linked to finance, too.
Yeah, sure.
But strategic commodities. I call it strategic commodities. I want to develop a little bit that. That is a very important thing for me, because when you sell grains, the people you sell grains are most of the time government. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's a strategic commodities. You cannot be without wheat or bread in the shops. So when you import wheat to make bread, mm-hmm. It's so strategical and critical and politically that the people you are dealing with are the highest ranking of the government, president, minister. And this is the way I started to be in contact in Africa especially, but in other places of the world, of the top people of the countries. So, and I was dealing with them, and I was supplying them with those commodities. I believe in a good condition because they were keeping on requesting me to supply them. And of course, when I went to see them, a trust was already established between them and myself. Mm-hmm. When I went to talk politics, I said, why not? Let's go, let's do it. And mm-hmm. this is a very important factor, I believe, in my success. If success.
But you had, when you were going in, even as recently as the early 80s, it feels recent to me anyway. I mean, it's not like.
How old
ancient,
are you?
I'm 51.
51, so in the 80s, you were 30.
Well, in the early 80s, yeah. Well, in the late, very end of the 80s. Yeah, it's true. I was an adult already, let's put it that way, and very caught up as a student and as a young guy in the story of apartheid, of course, But. So I'm still kind of fuzzy on how. I'm going to just allow that you had a knack. Do you know the word a knack? Just had a natural penchant, a natural way with. I wish I spoke more French. That commodity trading was a natural thing inherently for mm-hmm. you, but you had to go to South Africa and create a stable. You had to stabilize the whole commodity trade there because it didn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that true? So there,
no,
you,
was
there
was
no
that.
Price.
There were sanctions.
How did the,
they were sanctioned.
They were completely isolated.
Totally isolated.
Okay. So you break those agreements?
Yes, I break the sanction. Yeah. I break the sanction not in
so
the,
under,
not on the commercial part, not on the financial part, but I break the sanction because the sanctions were sanctions to contacts and dialogues. There were sanctions on cultural sanctions. There were sanctions in sport, you know, the
yes.
South African
couldn't
travel,
couldn't
be part of the Olympic Games. Or,
there was a cultural boycott.
So they were totally isolated. Mm-hmm. They were so how can you talk peace with a group of people if you don't have a way to dialogue with them? And they were. There was no the possibility of dialogue because they were really isolated. They were totally, and being isolated, they consider themselves as the victims and not anymore the people who are putting other people victims. So I break the sanction in the sense that I open channel of communication with them,
mm-hmm.
Channel of communication with their neighbor countries,
yes.
with whom they were at war.
Right.
And with no channel of communication, of course, because they were at war. So one of my work was to create those channel of communication, which was, as a matter of fact, breaking the sanction.
Was this just a personal choice that you made, again, from your own set of values? Did you have a trouble reconciling the young man who was...
I was supporting the French Algerian.
Okay.
I was not supporting it. This is it was a mistake. So
I see. Okay.
But
gotcha. I didn't realize that. So, and was it illegal?
Totally illegal is why I was arrested.
Yeah.
But you know, that put me in a situation where I am trying to put myself in the position of the other. I am trying to think the way the other thinks. In mm-hmm. other words, as I said in the movie Plot for Peace. The other can be me in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not prejudging anybody. And I was trying to understand how they were brought to the situation where they were. And the white, for example, which it was clear for me that being rejected, being put it at the... regarded as a heavy people, they had the sense of survival. They were convinced that if the other party will take over, they will be gone, they will be destroyed, they will be thrown to the sea, like my community
yeah.
was.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, I guess, which was when you got there, something clicked in your head, right, that this reminded you on some very basic level, very obvious level, about what you went through.
Absolutely.
And the mistakes that the French made.
It was, the mistake was yeah. not to reconcile the community so they can look at the future together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they can consider that the country of tomorrow is their common countries. I believe we had as much as French Algerian, we have as much rights to remain in Algeria than the Arabs we were living there.
Sure.
And in the same token, in South Africa, I was convinced that the white had also the right to remain in a new South Africa. Of course, South Africa where everybody would be equal.
Yeah, it was just that the infrastructure had to change clearly in both cases.
Absolutely.
It's just a matter of how it happened.
And
so there was a tinderbox, meaning that things were very volatile. When Nelson Mandela was about to be released, things could have blown up. Or even before that, because it was clear the tide had changed and now there was international support.
There was a serious risk for the white community to
yeah.
be wiped off.
Slaughtered. Yeah, thrown into the sea, as you said.
We should not forget that one of the slogans of the ANC, the movement in freedom movement of South African, black South African mainly, was one bullet, one white.
Mm-hmm.
Before the slogan was changed by Winnie Mandela as a more positive slogan, which was Free Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that risk. And the only way to overcome that risk would be that common future can be envisaged. Not mm-hmm. one party killing the other party or destroying the other party, which they were leading to.
Or even making the other party, you know, become refugees.
Like, yes, except that in Algeria, in Algeria we had the French passport, so we can at least cross the
right.
Mediterranean. In South Africa, there was no passport.
Right.
There was only South African passport. Yep. You know one thing about South Africa, which is extraordinary, and most of the people ignore, is, you know how you are South African? By the new constitution?
No.
You are South African because you live in South Africa, not because you are born in South Africa, not because your parents were South African.
Hmm.
At the moment you leave 5 years, this is a new constitution, this was a specific request of Mr. Mandela himself.
Yeah.
As long as you live in South Africa, you have the right to be considered as a South African. And that doesn't exist in any country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are American because you are born in America, or because you acquire the nationality later on.
Mm-hmm.
But in South Africa, you live 5 years, and you have the right of automatic South African passport. Whatever is your race, your religion, your age, it's a right. So it's extraordinary, this country, which is building to the future based on based on people who love the country so much that they live there
mm-hmm.
or stay there.
Well, I don't even think we have time to get into the other thread of the film about the communist threat or you know the neighboring countries which were aligned with Cuba and the Soviet Union.
Oh, the American.
Yeah, and the
American. It was a Cold War, and the American and the Russian were making war through proxies.
Yeah.
It was terrible. It was evil for them. You know, it was called the Cold War. People think that the Cold War was no battlefield. Yes, there were battlefields. There were people.
They were financing wars against warring factions.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Cubans were financed and supported by the Russians and fighting in Africa. The white regime of South Africa, the apartheid regime, and some of the revolutionary regime like Savimbi regime, the UNITA, were supported, financed, armed
by the Americans.
By the Americans.
Yeah.
He never said one word about his contribution.
Je pense que Jean-Yves Olivier, de toute façon, appartenait au service français.
The chance of being a double agent, we didn't care about this.
When you have a man like Jean-Yves, nothing will leak, but the results will be brought about. And that's what he did.
He would have played whatever other role, but not a political one.
What he was looking for, I'm not sure, because he never asked me money.
The mysterious businessman, codenamed Monsieur Jacques, played a leading role in the delicate negotiations which led to the multiple prisoner swap in Maputo, Mozambique, earlier this year.
I did want to get to the actual film part of the story, the documentary also, and how that came about. Again, it's called Plot for Peace. It's coming to New York City anyway, and in Washington, D.C., theatrically on October 31st. Boo. It's one of our big holidays.
Yeah. Yes, it's Hollywood. Halloween. I hope you will not consider me as a ghost.
Never. Jamais?
Jamais.
Jamais. And then it'll be in premiering in L.A. On the 5th of November, and then in San Francisco on the 7th. So you're getting quite a nice thing. How did this come about, though? I mean, it's not a very typical documentary. It's a lot of talking heads, but it's also a lot of archive footage from the time. It's amazing all the people involved in this documentary and how everybody the access is really amazing. Because you were able to create such strong relationships, as is mentioned in the film, with pre-apartheid and post-apartheid. That's the easier divide. You maintained relationships with those who...
Yes, of course.
In both, somehow or other. Which, I guess, you know, it speaks to the larger story about how peace was kept.
Yes, of course, and you know the magic...
Maybe it's the only way to do it.
The magic of this movie, those people which were fighting once against the other, have accepted to be all together in the movie.
Well, they weren't in one room. Let's just make sure people know that.
Yes,
but
you know,
they may as well have been.
No, 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 please. At the opening of the movie in Johannesburg 1 month ago, at the premiere, were seated in the audience Winnie Mandela, Wynand Du Toit was a soldier, the Rambo, South African Rambo of the Special Force, was a prisoner in Angola.
His name again?
Wynand Du Toit.
Okay.
And we're sitting Matthew Poza, which was a treasurer, a very freedom fighter from the ANC and a very important person in the ANC. There were Pik Botha from the previous regime, Minister of Foreign Affairs of South Africa. And you know, at the end of the movie, we went, we were put in very comfortable armchair in front of the screen and to have a Q&A. And Winnie Mandela, who is 80-something, stood and went to embrace Wynand Du Toit. It was extraordinary emotional. And she said publicly, she said, you know, at that time, I would have killed you, Winnie Mandela. At that time, but today it's time for me to embrace you because we have the same country and we are pursuing together for our country. It was extraordinary. Of course, it was in all newspaper in South Africa. One of the reasons the movie Plot for Peace was well received in South Africa. But you see, it's no. All these people have kept extraordinary relation because of me, because of the events, because of. But yes, enemies of yesterday are friends of today.
It's a remarkable idea because I just can't even wrap my mind around it. I'm not evolved enough to understand how someone can be so forgiving. And yet I hope to attain that level, you know, of just being evolved as that, you know?
The forgiving is one thing. Forgetting is another thing.
True.
This movie doesn't say forget. It says forgive.
No, in fact, always remember, if anything.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to remember. You have to remember the day of apartheid. Remember the days of apartheid, but forgive. It's a new page. It's future together. It's hope together. So let's do it and enjoy the fact that you forgive.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hi, this is Olympia Dukakis, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Okay, thank you so much. Merci bien for listening to that conversation. What do you think of that? Write me at adam@filmwax.com or chime in on Facebook at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. Or you can tweet us, of course, at filmwaxradio. Let me know what you think of any of these episodes, any of these segments, any of the episodes, any of my guests. Chime in with your suggestions. And most importantly, of course, please do subscribe on iTunes to the show. It only takes a minute to go to iTunes and to search Film Wax in the search field, and it comes up, and then all you have to do is click subscribe, and you can even click a star rating based on your feelings about the show. And there's even a place, if you're feeling really ambitious, to leave a comment, a constructive comment, if you please. And I'm very, very eager to hear from people because I live in a box. I'm a man in a box. You know? Well, I can't quite pull it off. I'm no Rob Ryden. But anyway, I do feel like a man in a box because I run into people all the time and they mention it. But, you know, it really means a lot to hear from people. So send in a note. And, you know, I'm on Facebook. So you can also search my name on Facebook and probably come up with that in your search results and then contact me that way as well. I'm very easy to reach. Oh, yes, Jacqueline Grimino, my dear friend. She cast me in a short last year on the Long Island Railroad on one Sunday morning and afternoon. And so, you know, I am very loyal, if nothing else. And she's a talented young lady, and she is raising money for a new short and to launch the production of a new short. And she's going to talk about it right now. You know, she's using Seed and Spark as a vehicle for that. And if you go back to episode 85 of the podcast, which is some ways back, with the founder of Seed and Spark, Emily Best, is on the show. And I haven't listened to that episode in quite some time. I'm kind of curious how it is in retrospect all these years later. But anyway, just to show you how long we've been doing the show, everybody's coming on. So feel free to contact me about that. You know, I'm going to get around to you sooner or later. So here's my conversation with Jacqueline. Okay. And then what I'm going to do is I'm just going to play out. All right, guys. So we'll be back next episode with Mr. Dick Cavett. That's right. You heard it here, folks. Dick Cavett. On the next episode, episode number 251 of Filmwax Radio. So thank you for listening.
Hello. Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
You know, we're getting ready to launch our campaign tomorrow, so...
Oh, is it tomorrow?
It's been a crazy week. Seems, yeah.
Okay, so... And what is the... Is it like typical, like it, what you would find in other Kickstarter tools?
Well, actually, we're using a site called Seed and Spark,
right,
which is particularly for indie filmmakers.
Well, Emily was a guest of mine many...
Oh, great.
A couple years ago, so...
I think I saw that in your archives, actually.
Oh, okay.
Cool. We decided to go with Seed and Spark particularly because they have a great program working with indie filmmakers specifically and with helping you directly reach your specific audience and then not only using that audience for the current project, but also hopefully expanding it for everyone's careers who is involved going future.
Well, talk about the project itself then.
Okay, so the project is called Sleeping with Earrings On. And it is an adaptation of a short play that we made this summer. So I directed it. A couple of my friends wrote it and starred in it. And we ended up winning the New York New Works Theater Festival this past September. It was really exciting. It was judged by a panel of Broadway producers and Emmy Award-winning writers. And it was kind of a surreal night. You know, we went through the finals. There were a lot of other amazing plays that were out there. But we really felt like ours had this... I don't know, like a feeling of love and hope that a lot of other things didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt like throughout our campaign throughout the rehearsals of the play, we were building our audience then as well. And everyone just got so involved and, you know, so excited. We did a lot of photos and fan opportunity things. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we actually won, which was a total surprise for us, but exciting, we had decided we would go forward and make a short film version. Just so that we could try to bring our story of love and hope and to a bigger audience, and so that's what we're doing.
What's the love of? What are you talking about? No.
Okay. Yes.
What is it about? What is the
so the story is about
Sleeping with Earrings On.
Is it? Can you hear me?
Yes, and it's called Sleeping with Earrings On.
Sleeping with Earrings On is the name, and it takes place the morning of a wedding. It's surrounded around three sisters: Bridget, the oldest; Maggie, the middle; and Georgie, the youngest. And it's Maggie's wedding. She's getting married to the love of her life, whose name is Kyle, who you actually find out throughout the course of it that Kyle is actually another woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really the point for us to say, okay, we want to trick the audience into thinking that Kyle is a man. But it actually turned out that most of our audience assumed that Kyle was going to be a man, so that once the other bride came out, you know, it was a total surprise, a twist, if you will. And we felt like our goal was to get the audience to fall in love with Maggie and the love story of Maggie and Kyle, so that by the time that reveal happened, either, you know, it doesn't really matter that she's a woman, or if you have mixed feelings about that subject, you would be challenged on those beliefs because you already love Maggie and you already love her story. So it's about unconditional love, and it's about being able to choose your family versus the blood family that you have and how a relationship can affect the other people around you.
Does sound like a really sweet, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I like it.
And so you haven't filmed it yet?
No, we have not filmed it yet. We are planning to film in December, in the second weekend of December as of right now. And we have a cast and crew of primarily women, which is really exciting for us. We specifically wanted to do that just not so much as like we all love men. A lot of us have boyfriends. We love them. But I have never done a cast and crew of primarily women before. And we are all interested in just giving it a try because we know a lot of really talented women. And, you know, like it's not exclusive. There will probably be a few men involved, but it was exciting for us to at least show people what we can do and kind of break stereotypes. You know, we have a female cinematographer and we have, you know, yeah, basically everybody. So it's awesome.
That is, well, you know, don't worry. There's plenty of productions where primarily men, I understand. True. So it's,
I have been on those.
And it's less intentional in a sense, you know. It's,
right.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
Right, exactly.
Cool. So keep me abreast of this whole, you know, you kind of partner up with Stephen Spark. It's like, it sounds like, yes, a real partnership.
It definitely is.
And that they provide a lot of different areas of infrastructure.
Yeah, it's like a mentorship almost.
Yeah, yeah.
An audience building mentorship. It's really cool.
Great. And then, mm-hmm, so you're going to launch this, by the time this airs, then I guess it will have been launched.
Yes. And then we'll be going for 30 days. So the last day of, okay, our campaign will be November 21st.
Okay.
And yeah, we're trying to raise $8,125 is our goal. So hopefully we do that. And I think regardless, we're really excited to just connect with people about this topic and about this story and just kind of see what makes people excited about it, you know, because we're already excited. So it's exciting.
We're excited. Okay.
Yay.
Well, good luck. And I'm sure you'll make your goal. And so yeah, much. We'll try to help. You got it.
Thanks, Adam. You're the best.
You're the best.